From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Abortion rights advocates in Texas say they are going to court after the Republican governor signed one of the country's most restrictive bans on abortion yesterday. The law bars abortions after a fetal heartbeat is detected. That's as early as 6 weeks into a pregnancy. It can be before many women even know they are pregnant. And while the law prohibits state officials from enforcing the ban, it allows anyone who wants to file lawsuits against anyone involved in the procedure after 6 weeks, even someone driving a friend to a clinic, to be sued. For more, let's bring in Ashley Lopez. She's a healthcare and politics reporter with KUT Radio in Austin, Texas. Hi, Ashley.
Hey there.
So let's set the scene. This law is one of many that was pushed through in red states. They've been blocked in many states by federal courts. The aim is to get the law to the Supreme Court and challenge Roe v. Wade. And just this week, the Supreme Court said it would take up another law that would ban the procedure of abortion after 15 weeks. Roe v. Wade is generally after 24 weeks for a ban when it's thought a fetus could survive outside the womb. So here in Texas, a ban after just 6 weeks. Tell us more about the Texas law.
Yeah, so the law prohibits people from getting an abortion once a fetal heartbeat is detected, which, as you mentioned, can be as early as about 6 weeks into a pregnancy. And like you said, this is before many women even know they are pregnant. And if you factor in wait times, which are required here in the state of Texas, and the time it takes to make an appointment and arrange childcare and stuff like that, abortion rights advocates say the law basically acts as a de facto ban on abortions in Texas. And currently, there's only one exception, and that's the way the law was passed, with an exception for a medical emergency. But the law has no exceptions for victims of rape or incest.
Okay, well, there's another component to the law that makes it unique among these laws banning procedures after 6 weeks. This one in Texas allows lawsuits against, well, you explain it, against anyone who someone might perceive as being involved in the procedure, but won't allow state officials to implement the ban. Tell us more.
Yeah, so the mechanism for enforcing the law is really what sets Texas's law apart from other of the so-called heartbeat bills. Instead of there being criminal penalties which are enforced by the state, which is usually how most abortion restrictions usually work, this law leaves enforcement basically to private citizens. So in this case, anyone, including people who don't live in Texas, by the way, can sue anyone who provides the procedure or helps or supports the woman in any way who ends up getting an abortion outside that time window set by the ban. And the civil penalties for that could be up to like $10,000.
So it's a civil penalty, but it's not people turning people in, you know, for some kind of criminal action.
Right, right.
But still, that's so odd that there's no state officials that are allowed to implement the ban. Look, as we said, we've seen similar laws in other states get held up in the courts. We know that this one as well will have legal challenges. So what is the sense of whether or not it will ever go into effect?
Well, it won't be going into effect by law until September 1st. But I think the way that the penalty and enforcement side was designed was to really make it hard to get a court involved, because usually the courts can stop a state from enforcing a law because this is this like network of private citizens having to sue, like that being the enforcement mechanism. It's a little harder for abortion rights advocates and abortion providers who usually sue these laws to figure out what venue they could do this in, what venue in the courts they could actually use to sue or block the ban. It's kind of tricky. I think this is why Texas's bill is a little more like interesting, because it's not going to follow the same kind of system of how, you know, abortion rights advocates usually block these kinds of laws.
Well, so that's so interesting. That's the explanation, because this way you can't take it to court, you know, if in fact these are just civil lawsuits. On the other hand, does that mean that the people who've written it, their main goal is not to get it to the Supreme Court through courts?
Right. So, I mean, abortion rights advocates have told me, like, that's already happening. There are already other bans. you know, we're moving through, you know, federal courts. And, you know, as you mentioned, there's already a big case before the Supreme Court. Their goal was just to have a law that's enforced. They told me that, you know, so many times an abortion restriction will be passed in Texas and, you know, it'll have the support of the, you know, the main party in power here, which are, you know, the Republican Party. And, you know, almost immediately before it can even go into effect in many cases, a court will swoop in and stop it. And they feel, abortion rights advocates feel like this hasn't been helping them because what they really want is to have laws in place, restrictions in place that actually restrict access to abortion in the state.
Yeah. Ashley Lopez, politics and healthcare reporter with Austin's KUT Radio. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The humanitarian disaster in Gaza is getting worse as fighting continues between Israel and the militant group Hamas. Israeli airstrikes have damaged and destroyed water pipes and sewage systems, homes and hospitals. Medical supplies are scarce as doctors try to care for the injured. Eli Sok joins us now from Jerusalem. He's with the group Doctors Without Borders, overseeing its mission in the Gaza Strip. Thank you for speaking with us. Welcome.
Thanks for receiving me.
And what does the humanitarian situation look like in Gaza today?
It's a complete disaster. So in terms of casualties, number of deaths, a lot got destroyed, the roads, ministries, buildings. It's a lot of pain and suffering from the population.
Yeah. Now, one of the buildings damaged, I understand, was one of your clinics. Can you tell us what happened?
Yes. So that's one of the clinics. It's a day clinic. There was no one during the shelling. So it happened last Sunday at 1 a.m. So they shelled, they bombed one building behind the clinic. I mean, with the impact, it destroyed one of the rooms in the clinic, so the sterilization room. There was no casualty, fortunately. I would say that it was collateral damage. So we were not targeted because I believe if they wanted to target us, they would have completely destroyed the clinic.
And we've heard reports that other clinics and hospitals are also destroyed in this shelling. Are the people in Gaza able to get the medical care that they need right now?
It's quite complicated even today. So since the last 10 days, shelling is ongoing every day, every night. The intensity starts to decrease a bit since yesterday, I would say. But it's always a risk once you move outside. So for the patients to reach the hospital and the medical staff to reach the facilities. And what is even more difficult now is that they shelled the roads. So you don't have now an easy access with cars. So that's another obstacle for the patients to reach any cares.
Can you describe the injuries that people are coming to your hospitals with?
So we are supporting a hospital in the north of Gaza, and we see trauma patients, so people who got injured after the blast of the buildings or any kind of blast. So it's shrapnels, burns, anything linked with the bombing.
Are medical supplies getting through?
No. So there is no supply, nothing getting through. We are still waiting. So I'm still waiting since at least 5 days to enter in Gaza. And that's the same for the whole humanitarian community. We're trying to send additional medical staff and medical supply, fuel, water, food. And they haven't opened the crossing yet for the staff and for the supply. So at the moment, they are just like using the stocks. We know they have some shortages, like the blood bags. We know that they are running out of fuel. So, yeah, it's a urgent need to open the crossing.
So you have not been able to get in to assess the damage yourself? No. You're hearing reports from your staff?
Yes, exactly. We have a good team there, almost 250 national staff on the ground, and we have almost 20 international staff. They try to restart the activity. So as I said, we are supporting one hospital in the north. Now we have opened the clinic who got damaged. So we have opened that clinic today. So what is really important for all of us to understand is that when we say we open and we restart the activities, that we are taking risk of being shelled because we don't have any guarantee from both parties that they won't shell where we are and when we do any movement. So it's a risky situation, but we have a highly motivated staff. They choose to come and to work, even knowing the risk that they're taking.
Well, to that point, your staff, your doctors, They live in Gaza. Has right. everyone been able to stay safe?
Yes. We haven't heard any casualties or death. But we know that there's a number of staff who lost houses because it got bombed. And we know that there are some staff who lost relatives.
Who lost relatives, right. Well, there is talk of a possible ceasefire in the days ahead. Do people there believe that a pause in the fighting is coming?
I think we need to keep the hope. And that's the only thing that we can do is to hope. So I hope that tomorrow I will be able to join my team and to bring a supply in Gaza. But yeah.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
We were fondly reminded recently of a 2005 movie called The Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants. If you don't remember, it's a story about four lifelong friends who find a pair of jeans that fits each of them perfectly, and they use these magic pants as a way of keeping in touch when they're apart over the summer.
Babe! Tibby, you look great! Turn around! You look wonderful! You look good!
They look great on you. Please buy them.
You try them on then.
Wear jeans.
Yeah, well, fast forward to 2020, and Kyra Peralt had a similar idea. She started keeping a journal about the challenges of the pandemic and then began sending it around the world to strangers, inviting other women to fill in the remaining lined pages of her black and white marbled composition notebook with their own stories. She calls it the Traveling Diary Tour, and it's making a stop now at Here and Now. Kyra, welcome from Montclair, New Jersey.
Hi, Peter. Thank you so much for this opportunity to talk about the Traveling Diary.
Oh, we're glad to talk about it. And we also actually have one of the contributors, Shonda Lee from Atlanta, Georgia. Shonda, welcome to you.
Hey, thanks. Happy to be here.
All right, Kyra, why don't you start? Where did the idea and the inspiration for this project come from?
Well, connecting women around storytelling was something that I've always had on my heart and mind. And the Traveling Diary happened to be born during a time of deep isolation for me. Having to adapt my whole life to living under one roof with two kids, a husband, a startup that I was trying to get off the ground, I felt isolated. I felt disconnected. I have friends that I can talk to and share intimate things with, but I really, really, really wanted to know what was going on with other women and who were in places that I knew I wouldn't be able to get to, especially given the circumstances we were under.
Well, one of those women was Shonda. Let's bring her in.
Yes.
Yeah. You joined the Traveling Diary Tour pretty early on, right? I mean, did you know each other at all?
Not really. We met as a result of a mutual friend. I didn't even know who Kyra was. She didn't give me background on you or anything. So, but I'm an open person like that. I was like, okay, cool, I'll call her. And then, well, actually, you emailed me, and then that was the beginning of our connection. And then we got on FaceTime or Zoom, Skype, one of those. And it was like, when I looked at you, Kyra, it was like I knew you already.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's the whole point, isn't it? I mean,
you're
seeking in the void for something there, and you found it. So that was why you got involved? I mean, yeah. I wonder if you could share some of your own experience that made you think this was a good idea for you.
Well, I am a health and fitness pop singer, and prior to COVID, my band was doing cardio concerts, and those were in-person concerts where people come and they wear sweat clothes and they bring a towel and water. Wow. And my band performs live for them while they dance to our choreography. Oh my God, it's so much fun. It's a big sweat box. And so you can imagine when COVID hit, how we had to just completely shift gears. And that was right around the time that this opportunity came to me. And what I was feeling was very disconnected from my audience and really kind of sad about it. Sad about how social distance was becoming the norm. I wrote this in the journal too. I personally believe in responsible connection. In other words, everybody's not suspect. You know, I'm not going to not see my mom. But I understand why people have made those choices. It just, for me, it was so disconnected. It was like I cried a lot. So when she actually talked about a physical journal, diary that I could hold in my hand and write in with a pen, like old school. I tell you, when I opened the package and I looked at the diary, I read the story. And the first thing I did, honestly, I smelled it because
really?
I have this thing about the scent of books, like that smell of the newspaper or the magazine or that old book that, you know, grandpa left. Like that stuff really pulls memories out for me. So the first thing I did was I smelled it and then I started crying like, oh my gosh, this is it. And I immediately felt like I was connected to the people who I, that I of course never met, but whose stories were already in the book. So I think my entry was only the fourth one in there.
Would you mind reading some of your entry? Could you do that?
The first thing I did when I received this notebook was pull it out of the plastic envelope and smell it. I wanted to smell and imprint in my memory the beauty and humanity of each of you and myself. I've always been like that. Smells create strong memories for me, and this experience, this sharing memories with you, is now forever imprinted in my memory. Even as I write this, my eyes swell with tears of appreciation and love for all humanity. To tell you the truth, I think COVID-19 hit my family back in October last year because it started on a trip to Jacksonville in January to visit my foster sister who just delivered my niece prematurely at 26 weeks or 29 weeks, I forget which now. She told me that she'd quit smoking, drinking, and doing anything that could harm the baby during her pregnancy. Yet baby was having a very hard time thriving and insisted on being born almost 2 months before her time. When I arrived at my sister's house, the first thing I smelled was cigarette smoke. I wanted to deny it, but clearly it was in the house. After spending that first night in her bed, I woke up with a gnarly, annoying cough that I couldn't shake. Not long after, chest pain was, and eventually I had a fever. This illness lasted 2 to 3 weeks, and in that time, my beautiful niece, she died of respiratory failure. My whole family was brokenhearted, and we mourned for a long time. I've never seen a casket so small. It all boils down to continuing to have a loving experience of life in the face of so much fear. I'd like to continue to be a beacon of light, love, and faith during this time and for as long as I live.
I'm so sorry to hear about your niece. What does it feel like to read that right now?
I still get choked up, Peter. It's like I just wrote it. Yeah. It's neat to feel, you know, and that's one of the things I think that has come out of this, you know, like that ability to feel things deeply, even if it hurts. And that's what connects us as human beings. So I definitely feel that.
Kyra, what about you? When you hear that, what do you feel?
It touches me deeply in so many ways because I'm a mom, I'm a sister, and I can connect with the sense of just feeling like you're human and someone else sees you.
And isn't it something, Kyra and Shonda, that it took this virus, this pandemic, this pain that we all went through for so long to figure that out, what you're just saying? Like, isn't that kind of remarkable?
Yeah. I mean, it's not funny, but it is kind of crazy when you think about it. And you know what else is interesting about that, Peter, is so many people got real about where they are with their health.
Yes.
You know, because I saw so many people walking, jogging, riding their bike, you know, eating salads, just like on that and like really valuing their health and realizing it could be taken from you at any moment.
And I'll add to that, and valuing our relationships with other people, valuing our friendships, our connections, our mental health, and to be able to share about our experiences with strangers. There's something about it that just feels cathartic.
Yeah, but now what? The pandemic is turning the corner. Our lives are getting back into gear. We're going back into our communities that we had before the pandemic started. And I was going to ask you, like, does that mean that the diary is going to stop? And after hearing what you're saying here, I'm like, no, you can't let it stop, right?
No way.
But does it work in normal times?
Yes, 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 it does. Storytelling has always been here. It's always been here. It isn't going anywhere. And as the traveling diary community continues to grow and connect, women are finding connections that are authentic in a space that feels safe and real.
Is 700 members worldwide, more than that now, I believe. London, Australia, Portugal, Hong Kong, New Jersey, Atlanta. You've really made an impact. That's how far the book has traveled. Kyra Perrault, founder of the Traveling Diary Tour, a physical notebook that is sent around the world and clearly making a big difference. Women can sign up online at thetravelingdiarytour.com. We also heard from one of the members, one of the writers, Shonda Lee. Thank you both so much. It was a real pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you, Peter. That was awesome.
I'm Yoe Shaw.
I'm Kia Miakonatis.
We're the hosts of the NPR podcast, Invisibilia.
You can think of Invisibilia kind of like a sonic blacklight.
When you switch us on, you will hear surprising and intimate stories.
Stories that help you notice things in your world that maybe you didn't see before.
Listen to the Invisibilia podcast from NPR.
Indiana, Oklahoma, Texas. Those are the latest states this week to cut the extra $300 weekly unemployment pandemic benefit. The changes will take effect in the coming weeks, and they come as employers across the country are struggling to find workers. Why don't we bring in MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent Ali Velshi. Ali, welcome.
Good to be with you again.
Good to have you. Now, more than three quarters of Republican-led states are cutting these unemployment benefits, the extra ones. What's the reason they're giving, and how many people will be affected?
Well, the reason they're giving is that this $300 extra dollars, this is on top of normal unemployment, which amounts to about $7.50 an hour a week, is working against people going back to work. Arguing that it's too rich. If people get that much money, it's easier for them to choose not to work than to take a job. It's not really an entirely valid argument. There is a reason why some people may be staying on government assistance as opposed to going back to work. But a lot of that has to do with uncertainty about job reopenings and the permanence of jobs, childcare as it relates to schooling and matters like that. On the left of the political spectrum, the argument is that these people are earning wages typically that would have been too low. So they're taking what amounts to $300 a week from the federal government, $300 a week from the state government. That amounts to about $15 an hour, which is more money than they might earn in the private sector. So it's a bit of an ideological argument. The idea is if you take away this extra unemployment benefit, people might go back to work.
What do you think? Is that true?
I think it's more nuanced than that. I think if this were a permanent thing, there might be a greater concern, but this is an added unemployment benefit until businesses reopen. So I don't think that there's a long-term benefit. I do think there are some people who might make more money going back to a job who are concerned about the uncertainty of whether they'll have to take care of their children when school starts or whether there are going to be other shutdowns if there's another wave of coronavirus. But fundamentally, you are seeing across the country, and you and I have talked about this before, companies that are raising minimum wage because they realize they've got to do that to stay more competitive. So the idea that people are staying home to be lazy or mooch off the government probably isn't accurate. The idea that companies are having trouble finding employees because the unemployment payments are amounting to $15 an hour, there is some truth to that.
Hmm. Some states are now offering bonuses in other ways. Look at Montana. They're ending the $300 unemployment benefit, but now they're also offering a $1,200 bonus to people who go back to work for at least 4 weeks. still going to cost the state money. Understand, help me understand why like one option is a bad idea and the other one is a good idea.
Well, I think you could probably find economists who can argue that they're very similar, right? If the state provides money that stimulates the economy, the state gets money in the end because people work and they pay taxes and they buy things. It's generally speaking more efficient in our society if that money comes from the private sector. So the idea that you incentivize people with some money in order to go to work means that their employment is probably more permanent, and at some point the government gets out of the business of subsidizing workers. So generally speaking, if there's some question about people taking work right now because of uncertainty, using the incentive to get people back to work as opposed to the incentive, and I'm using other people's words, but as opposed to providing an incentive for people not to work, is probably more productive in the long term. You're also seeing companies offering incentives and rewards to people if they can find employees to fill open spots.
Like Chipotle. MSNBC yep. anchor and economics correspondent Ali Velshi, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
The crisis in the Middle East has deep roots. In the next few minutes, we're going to try to trace them. Now, it's bound to feel like cliff notes, but we're hearing from listeners an outline of some sort is needed. And it's bound to have critics because this fraught history is viewed differently by both sides. But simply put, both Jews and Arabs have been in this region for millennia, governed at different times by empires, the last, the Ottoman. In the late 1800s, Jews started a Zionist movement, a move for a Jewish state in response to rising anti-Semitism. In 1917, the British defeated the Ottoman Empire in what was then called Palestine and occupied the area, enacting the British Mandate, a dual obligation to both the Arab and Jewish populations, endorsed by the League of Nations, to create homelands. The subsequent Balfour Declaration pledged to create a Jewish state, but an agreement could never be hammered out. In 1947, the mandate ended. In 1948, the Jews declared the State of Israel. A coalition of Arab states and Palestinians declared war. Arabs poured out of the area or were forcibly removed. Jews from other Middle East countries and survivors of the Holocaust poured in. And in what many saw as a miracle, Israel, the size of New Jersey, aided by allies like the U.S., fought them off. Well, there would be violent spasms for decades. In the 1967 Six-Day War, Israel battled Egypt and Jordan and emerged with control of the Gaza Strip, the Sinai Peninsula, the West Bank, the Golan Heights, Arab East Jerusalem. Thousands of Palestinians were displaced or came under Israeli occupation. In 1973, Egypt's Anwar Sadat led the bloody Yom Kippur War, which Israel only narrowly won. Over the years, the Palestinians split between the militant group Hamas in Gaza, the more moderate PLO in the West Bank. Israel characterized Palestinian uprisings in recent years as terrorist attacks. Palestinians say they're living under apartheid. Well, the next several decades also saw many attempts at peace. Aaron David Miller was involved in those efforts as an advisor to the State Department. Today, he's a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. So, Aaron, have I got that outline right?
You know, Robin, in a minute and a half or two, it's actually a rather condensed and pretty good summary, keeping in mind that the highways and the byways are going to be interpreted by different sides in different ways. And the real sad thing here is both sides tend to interpret the conflict as a morality play, the forces of goodness on one hand versus the forces of darkness on the other, when in reality, I think Goethe had it right when he defined tragedy as a conflict of competing justices. And in this case, each side really does have competing needs that now seem to be almost impossible to reconcile. But yes, I think it's a good summary.
That's about right. Well, when you mention that the morality aspect of this, the founding of Israel happened at a time when there was huge understandable sympathy in the world. The Jews had almost been exterminated by the Nazis when other countries, you know, welcomed Israel as a state. We mentioned one of the major mileposts, the Six-Day War between Israel and primarily Egypt in 1967. As we said, Israel gains new territory, the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, the Golan Heights, East Jerusalem. Can you draw a direct line to the conflict today from the results of this war? The Israelis saying it was a war. We won. You take land when you win in a war. And Arabs, Palestinians saying this was, again, a land grab of land belonging to the Palestinians.
1967 created more breathing space to the Israelis in response to what they perceived to be an existential threat from the Egyptians and the Syrians. But the reality is it also created a problem. It created what still dogs and frankly drives the Israeli-Palestinian issue, and that's the proximity problem. But it also created an incentive on both sides as the years passed to explore the possibilities for peace agreements. And the war that truly created the modern version, successful and unsuccessful, of the peace process was the 1973 war. At that point, Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger, eager to diminish Soviet influence in the region and to demonstrate that the United States could play an effective role, Kissinger started on his rather extraordinary journey of 18 months, three disengagement agreements. Those disengagement agreements would lay the basis for the next milestone, which was the transformative one. Anwar Sadat, never believing, I think, that he could actually militarily vanquish Israel, ended up committing himself to visit Jerusalem in November 1977, and there began a pathway that would lead to a fundamental breakthrough and, to some degree, a transformative one between Egypt and Israel. Jimmy Carter, in September of 1978, he convened the parties at a 12-day summit at Camp David, where they hammered out a couple frameworks, one to govern what might happen to the West Bank, fraught and never fulfilled, but grounds for an Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty, which would ultimately be signed on the White House lawn in March of 1979.
Just to sum up what you've said, this is Egyptian President Anwar Sadat, Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin, brought to Camp David by American President Jimmy Carter, and he did announce the peace deal, the Camp David Accords, peace between Israel and Egypt. Let's listen.
The world prayed for the success of our efforts. And I am glad to announce to you that these prayers have been answered.
But Aaron David Miller, the Palestinians weren't part of that deal. Was there a fatal flaw here? Why are we where we are?
The Israelis, Menachem Begin, I believe, made that deal not just to make peace with the largest and most powerful Arab state, but Begin made that deal because I think he saw another quid pro quo, that he would, in fact, trade Sinai for peace with Egypt. But it was an effort to maintain Israeli control over the West Bank and, of course, over Jerusalem. The Palestinian issue, from the Israeli point of view, remained fraught. It wasn't a problem to be solved between two states. It was to be solved between a state and a national movement, violent at the time, seeking to become a state. And it drove home to both parties both the incentives of proximity. Their pasts, their presents, and their futures were inextricably linked together. But the proximity problem also created one of the great constraints. Two peoples inextricably linked, living kilometers away from one another, one as occupier, one as occupied.
Well, 1987 brings the first intifada or uprising. These are deadly clashes in Israel, Gaza, the West Bank. This is, again, where Palestinians begin to be painted as terrorists, as you said. This is a group of people that feels occupied, has no sense of justice that the Palestinian state they've been promised was ever going to come to fruition. They wanted part of Israel as their capital of this state. They wanted the right of Palestinians to return. And that, in and of itself, completely erases the notion of a Jewish state, Israel. So that is unacceptable. Bill Clinton steps in with Israel and the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, the now political leaders. They signed the Oslo Accords in 1993, but cannot get past the stumbling blocks of who has the right to Jerusalem, who has the right to the West Bank. Israel begins building settlements in this Palestinian territory. Is there any chance to get past that basic impasse?
Camp David, July 2000, Ehud Barak, Yasser Arafat, Bill Clinton. A summit convened, and I was one of the dozen or so Americans there with the best of intentions. But the reality is that the gaps on the core issues, Jerusalem, borders, security, refugees, were Grand Canyon-like in character. The summit did not succeed. It ushered in a period of sustained violence, the second intifada and terror, from which I would argue to you, Robin, that the Israeli-Palestinian relationship has still not 20 years later recovered. And if you ask me, can I envision an Israeli prime minister and a Palestinian president standing before their respective bodies and saying to each other, we still have to make peace with one another, but we hereby declare that our conflict is over? I cannot imagine that statement being made today or for the foreseeable future. I haven't given up hope, but most of my illusions that drove me during those years are gone, and the current crisis has only deepened, in my judgment, the sense of mistrust, the toxicity of politics on both sides. But I cannot see any pathway forward to address the comprehensive question that you posed at the beginning of this segment. Can Israelis and Palestinians end their conflict? The answer right now is a resounding no.
Aaron David Miller, Senior Fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Aaron, dispiriting, but we thank you for your expertise. Thank you.
Robin, thank you.
It's a vegetable. No, it's a flower. No, it's both. It is, of course, the artichoke. Have you ever looked at one in the supermarket and thought, what do you do with that? Well, here now, resident chef Kathy Gunst has some ideas. Like you pull the leaf, you get the leaves sometimes and you dip them in butter.
Well, that's definitely one way to do it. They are a bit intimidating for some cooks, and I sense you might be one of them.
Yes.
Interestingly, I mean, when you look at them, you're right. They're these sharp, thorny, pointy green and purple tinge leaves. And you've got to wonder, like, who looked at this thing and said, oh, delicious, let's eat it. But the truth is, we've been eating artichokes for over 3,000 years.
Yeah, well, somebody may have in here for 3,000 years. But if you're doing it for the first time, and by the way, explain that they are also flowers.
They are actually the immature flower bud of the thistle plant. They look thistle-like when you look at them, and they're harvested and eaten before they actually bloom. So let's take you through, like, the simplest thing. You take an artichoke. What do you do with this? First thing you're going to do is trim a bit off the pointy end of the leaves. Then you're going to, if you want to, trim the leaves with a kitchen scissor or just leave them. You're going to steam it. Very simple. It's still whole. You're going to put it into some boiling water. Let it cook for about 25 minutes. When you pull one of those green leaves off, it should come off easily. It's done. You drain it, and there you are. What I've done is made a roasted garlic aioli, which sounds very fancy, but it is mayonnaise, whether you buy it from the jar or make it yourself. You roast a whole head of garlic with olive oil, salt, and pepper. Take out these soft, sweet, nutty-flavored garlic. Smash them, add your mayonnaise and lemon juice, and dip the leaves into this dip, and then you keep going. And I'll take you through it in the recipe, because the prize is in the middle. That's the heart. And you have to pull away some inedible part called the choke, as in artichoke. And then you get to the heart, which is tender, almost meaty, very wonderful flavor.
And you can do that, you know, pull that whole thing apart, or you can buy them jarred or canned, the artichoke hearts. And what do you do with them?
What do you do with the hearts?
Well, the hearts,
Yes, so you can get to them by steaming it and pulling the leaves off and eating them. You, as you said, can open a jar. There's wonderful jars of marinated artichoke hearts. I do a fabulous dish, really perfect for this time of year, of braised chicken thighs with artichoke hearts from the jar or the can, green olives, and shallots. It cooks very slowly, and you even add some of the marinade from the jar of artichokes, which just helps enhance the flavor. And I just wanted to take a second to say, an artichoke is not the easiest thing to describe the flavor of. A lot of people compare them to asparagus, but I find that they really have their own thing, and it's earthy and meaty and vegetal and spring-like. Anyway, the chicken dish is well worth trying.
Well, it also is something that you can grow. And I want to bring in our own Peter O'Dowd, because he's there in Phoenix. And yes. Oh, my gosh, Peter, we're going to post them. We've seen here on Slack some pictures of your artichokes, and they are just, you know, awesome.
They're huge. You know,
yeah, they are huge. They're huge. And when Kathy said thistle, this makes sense because it's so hot there. So, but what do you do with them?
Well, okay, let me just say that this thistle plant took up like a quarter of my entire garden. So if you're going to grow these at home, just be prepared for how big this plant is. We just did exactly what Kathy said. We chopped off the blossom or the bud. We boiled it because we didn't have a steamer basket. We were in the process of moving. And then we just melted some butter. And you're right, the fun of it is all the heart. You know, all the leaves are kind of a lot of trouble for not much satisfaction, in my opinion. But then when you dig into the heart and you finally find it, it's like a little treasure. It's great.
Oh, listen, it's so great. I'm jealous, Peter. In Maine, I have friends who are gardeners who've grown them, and maybe they get one or two. But also, I'd like to recommend an artichoke and asparagus soup, which uses the hearts. Mm-hmm. Again, it can come out of a jar or a can. Just a wonderful spring soup. And let's just say, these are really good for you. They're low in fat. They have 7 grams of fiber and 60 calories. Win, win, win.
Win, win, win. Except for the work. Maybe, but actually,
you guys, come on. It's I know. It.
No, but I'm thinking of the times I've sat at somebody's service at an hors d'oeuvre and you pull the leaf off and you dip it, although your garlic thing sounds much better than just the heated up butter. And then you have to drag it across your teeth, you know, to get something off of it. But I'm thinking, Peter, with your kids there, this might be more of an adventure for them.
Oh, it was fun. Yeah, it was definitely an event. I'm not sure that we're going to do it again because of the garden space situation and because of the extra work. I'm sorry, Kathy, but it is a lot of work. But it was everyone at the table was like, yay, we're doing this. This is exciting.
I think
the kids loved it.
I have a new title for both of you. You're artichoke wimps. It's worth it. The flavor is extraordinary.
Here and Now is Kathy Gunst. We're going to have all her recipes, which will always make everything taste better, at hereandnow.org. Kathy, thank you as always.
Thank you. Great to talk to you both.
Mm-hmm. And I'm Robin Young here in Boston. We got Gardener Peter there in Phoenix.
It's Here and Now.